It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Yesterday was a fun day. Evidently talking about crazy people and vaccines, crazy people and 5G turning magnetic is something that the YouTube folks not thrilled with. So we are put in YouTube jail for a week for medical misinformation. And I'm trying to figure out, YouTube. Again, this is one of those things where I'm racking my brain. Never once have I said, don't get the vaccine. Never once have I said it's a hoax. Never once have I bought into any of the conspiracy theory, any of the nonsense. But medical misinformation for mocking. And this is where I'm going, YouTube. I'm mocking Sherry Tenpenny, half a pack. I don't know. I'm mocking this woman for saying, look, you're a medical doctor. Be smarter than this. Because she said that, you know, people who get the vaccine, the 5G, somehow there's a mixture, and now you could stick metal to your body, and I guess you walk by the knife drawer and you get stabbed. I don't know, but somehow the YouTube folks, the good folks at YouTube, and it's a good thing we don't do an awful lot there, but the good folks, wanted to get our attention. So it's one of these things where you go, you do know what mocking is, right? Now, I understand they do everything with AI. There are no humans who actually sit and go through anything. I did find it funny when they said, you violated our policy, and they sent the entire show back. I would have loved to have said, you know, well, what exactly was it that you thought was wrong? And within, you know, minutes of the of our appealing it, we were denied. So again, it's one of those fun kind of things where you're not even allowed to mock the crazy people without being shut down. So again, good thing most of our audience is still on terrestrial radio and elsewhere. But I just thought it was funny. I thought I would start there because if anyone, you know, if you heard yesterday's show, nobody, and I want to clarify. Nobody could misconstrue what I said as anything close to medical misinformation unless you're a crackpot. If you're an anti-vax kook, then yeah, you probably would go, well, he was saying stuff I don't agree with. Then. And it got me thinking, are the folks at YouTube, are they now the anti-vaxxers? I sure hope not. Sure hope not. But, you know, we're going to do our week in YouTube jail. And then not, I guess we're never going to be allowed to talk about vaccines, COVID-19 or 5G even, I guess. I'm not sure which part they found offense by. Again, I would like a ruling. I guess that's the brave new world. Listen to the podcast. You can get that at thericksmithshow.com. So some news today. Evidently, the Trump Justice Department seized the phone records of a couple of Democratic lawmakers. And, you know, this is one of those stories where I'll be honest. I read it and I go, okay, what's the breaking news? We didn't know this already. Oh, we didn't know this. Oh, okay. We're just now finding out that he actually did what we knew he was doing all along. Okay. Now I'm getting it. Just like the other day when Don McGahn, Trump's first White House counsel, testified that he felt trapped. He was being pressured to lie because he was told to fire Robert Mueller, and he was told to go and say, no, you didn't do any of that. And he was like, you know, I felt trapped. You know, oh, poor me. You tell the truth, man. Where's your patriotism? Where's your patriotic duty? Where's your law degree? And I read that story and I'm like, didn't we already know that? Didn't we know that everything that came out of the White House during those 4 years was a lie? It was like opposite day every day. And it got me thinking about, you know, what other crimes do we know are coming? And I had this conversation today of, you know, someone said, well, you know, that's not a big deal. Yes, it is a big deal. It is a big deal to obstruct justice. It is a big deal to spy on your political enemies. Remember, there was a guy a long time ago. What was his name? They broke into a hotel. They put duct tape on the door that a security guard caught. What was his name? Tricky Dick. Yeah, Richard Nixon. Yeah. Nixon got caught for trying to spy on the Democrats. And, you know, a piece of duct tape was his downfall. You don't think in this day and age where everything, literally everything, is somehow tracked by some kind of computer, you don't think that somehow when we start looking into all of this stuff that they're going to find it? And we're going to find a lot of the crimes and a lot of the things that the DOJ did under Billy Barr, and maybe even going back to the elf on the shelf, Jeff Sessions. Maybe we're going to find stuff then. But it got me thinking again, you know, there were all those crimes that we were talking about the last 4 years that you knew. And I kept saying, you know, these are things that we know. Imagine the stuff that we don't. Imagine just how bad things were. I mean, it ended on a high note. He did incite a riot. He did basically launch a coup attempt. So, you know, that's right up there at the top. You know, but a whole bunch of the other stuff that, you know, basically encouraging right-wing white supremacist terrorists to rule the country. It just got me into this thought process of, you know, how many things do we remember? And, you know, you stop and you go back and you think of all the arm twisting he probably did. Because we've got the Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, we got the transcripts. That was kind of strong arming. And, oh, do you remember the week before when we found out about Rudy and that we heard the phone call this week of Rudy basically strong arming his Ukrainian equal? Remember that? Remember that didn't happen? Remember how clean is the fresh driven snow? Or orange snow. But, you know, how many foreign leaders did he strong arm for his own political gain, for his own economic gain? I now want to know. I want to know what that meeting with Putin in Helsinki, why we couldn't have an interpreter in there, why there were no notes taken. I think we need to know. Again, these are investigations that have got to happen. What deals were made? You know, we still haven't figured out the hush money stuff. You know, there are a lot of investigations here. You know, the fact that, you know, you've got Trump telling McGahn to obstruct justice. How many other people did he strong arm? And, you know, I remember that movie on the big tall guy, the former FBI guy who got fired. I'll remember his name in a minute because it's not really all that important. But the story that he told about going in and meeting with Trump and being just kind of forced into this uncomfortable feeling. How many people do you think Trump, you know, basically strong-armed into doing, well, whatever crime? You know, if James Comey, the FBI director, feels uncomfortable, imagine what, you know, go down the list of any of the people who worked in the White House. And imagine, you know, he only chose the most loyal. Because if you remember the story about Comey going there, I only want loyal people. I want people loyal to me. You know, how many of those loyal people did then perjure themselves? How many of those people who did then obstruct justice? I think it's important. I think it's important to know how many crimes that last administration committed. And you go through all of the other things that still need to be investigated, from his tax returns to his business dealings to, you know, to, well, everything the entire syndicate pulled off, from Ivanka to Jared to Dumb Jr. to the other one that I can never remember his name. And then the girls who were all there. You know, how much criming did they do at his behest? How much money laundering? How much extortion? I mean, if you're like, what's that right? James Patterson? He couldn't write this. You couldn't dream up. And this is, again, the stuff that we have a sense of what happened. We know what was going on between Kushner and the Saudis. Kushner is in the Israelis. We know what was going on. They were wheeling and dealing. We just don't know the numbers yet. You know, there was actually, from what we're now finding out, a proposed nuclear venture with Saudi Arabia. Were we going to give Saudi Arabia nuclear weapons? Was that going to happen? And then let's not forget the inaugural committee. How many crimes came on day one? How many crimes came on day one? I mean, really? they brought in, what was it? Well over $100 million. How much of that went? One for the committee, one for Donald, one for Ivanka, one for Dum Dum. You know, one for the committee, one for Donald. How did that work out? How much graft went on there? How much thievery? We're fine. We now know, you know, how many people stayed in his hotels just to curry favor. Because that's who he was. And again, this isn't new. None of this is new. We knew this in 2015. They knew it in 2016 when people voted for him. We knew the crimes were coming. In fact, on Inauguration Day, I said this will be the most corrupt administration in the history of the country. There are a couple of presidents who are in their graves going, thank God, someone's going to take the title. I can now rest. History will remember that guy as the most corrupt ever. Now, for me, I'm looking at the Democrats and I'm going, why aren't we doing more? Why isn't the Department of Justice pursuing this? Why isn't Congress pursuing this? Why don't we have tons of investigations all going on simultaneously, moving us towards where I hope it ends up that we find out so that this doesn't happen again. And we do make the office of the presidency more transparent so that we never have another criminal president again. I mean, stop and think about the allegations that are going on right now of spying on journalists and spying on Democratic lawmakers, of seizing their phone records. I mean, you know, I have friends who, you know, they say, look, we know we were spied on. We know that they were tracking us. This is the kind of stuff, and you know, it all sounds funny. It all sounds hysterical that, you know, the criming that that administration did. But this is the stuff of dictators. And look, as long as you're on the side of them, everything's great. We're winning. You know, we're getting what we want. But heaven forbid you fall out of favor. And look, you saw that happen with Trump on a number of people that he brought in. You think of, you know, Elf on the Shelf. They brought little Jeffy in. Jeffy did one thing he didn't like. He recused himself in the Mueller thing. And whoop, now Jeffy's got to go. And it went down the line. You go to, you know, any of his appointees. And you just, you stop and you go, when do we get to the bottom of it? And when do we hold them accountable? Because we're in this moment. We're in this moment where the faithful still believe that he got cheated. He's out there lying to this day. He's out there, you know, making stuff up to this day that I don't believe he thinks is false. I believe he's so deluded that he believes he won. I think he does believe his BS. Now, the people who are around him who are still spewing it, they're in it for the money. They're grifters. Just like, you know, Tenpenny and her clan, I think it's all about the money. As is most of what happens on the radical right. It's all about the cash. It's all about the grift. But as I'm looking at this, I keep coming back to, we need to know who the criminals were. We need to know who, what they did, and they need to be held accountable. Because they are tearing this country apart with their lies, their deception, and of course their lobbying, because now they're all got gigs back to lobbying. And you've got Republican politicians who are scared to death to speak out and say, hey, this is wrong. Because they're all scared to death that they're going to get primaried from the kooks and the far right of the party, of which they were yesterday. And this is the problem with the Republican Party. They keep getting crazier and crazier and crazier. You know, I remember when Newt Gingrich was extreme. I remember when Ronald Reagan was considered extreme. You couldn't get either one of them elected today as a Republican. You might be able to get Reagan elected as a Democrat. No way you got him elected as a Republican. Because they've gone to that extreme. And it really truly is frightening. To the point where you've got a couple of these governors who... DeSantis in Florida, way off the beaten path. And this guy in Texas is always fun too. Always loved Texas. Because the Texas governor says now they're going to build the wall. Texas is going to build its own wall. Don't need any federal money. And they're going to be locking people up and they're going to be doing all that stuff. He's going to build a big, beautiful wall. Now, understand, this is him wanting to be the next Trump. This is him vying for Trump's attention so that he can run for president in 2024. And as I said, you know, on Inauguration Day years ago, Trump wasn't my real concern, because I thought we could bounce back from that. I thought we'd see the crimes, our system, our institutions would hold, and we would hold him accountable. But it would be the next person, the person with the Trump kind of extreme ideology, but less impulsive and less crazy. And more political savvy. So that all the horrible things that they want to do, they could have done, but just not raise the attention of everybody around us. Which is why, again, I come back to, there needs to be an investigation on all this stuff. We need to know the crimes. They need to be held accountable. There needs to be a parade of perp walks. That simple. Love to hear your thoughts. Do you have any favorite crimes? We should do that. A series of baseball cards based on the crimes of the Trump administration. That would be fun. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. More American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day workers at the Dodge truck plant in Warren, Michigan, went out on a wildcat strike. Workers were fed up with the endless attacks from management and disappointing contract negotiations the year before. Wildcat strikes had become almost commonplace in Detroit area auto plants the previous summer. Arbitrary discipline, deteriorating working conditions, and frustration with the union's response all led to the three-day walkout. 10 days earlier, 100 workers had staged a sick-in over working conditions. When the company threatened firings, more workers dropped their tools. Now, 4 had been fired, including the second shift chief steward. The response was immediate. Within an hour, the plant was virtually shut down. 6,000 workers voted to continue the strike. Wildcat leaders noted that virtually all the routine antagonisms among workers, young versus old, black versus white, women versus men, had melted away in solidarity. Socialist and anarchist workers in the plant published their recollections in a commemorative pamphlet entitled Wildcat, Dodge Truck, June 1974. In it, they state, quote, "We were excited by the collective decision of thousands of Chrysler employees to deny the authority of daily wage labor and, for even 4 days, to say no to the demands of the alarm clock, the production line, bosses, union bureaucrats, judges, and cops. It was, in fact, a total frustration with and rejection of all the things inside and outside the plant which exercise control over our lives." By the time it was over, 30 strikers had been arrested. Strike leaders were branded as communist agitators by the union, and area judges issued injunctions to end the picketing. The Wildcat may have failed, but workers had pushed back against management offensives.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the big story this week, you know, as we've been talking about all week, this ProPublica piece, the fact that some tax returns were leaked. We now got to see that Jeff Bezos didn't pay any taxes for a couple of years. In fact, you know, a couple of those years took the child tax credit that was meant for people making under $100,000. We also find out 55 companies paid zero, spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbying. And you wonder, you know, how did we get the tax code that we got? And as I've argued, you know, from the beginning, this is it's working exactly the way it's supposed to. This is the way the lobbyists want it, to make sure that the wealthier get wealthier. And well, we starve the beast until they can drag it in the bathtub and drown it. Here to share some thoughts on the ProPublica piece and maybe how we move forward to correct our problems, I've asked our good friend Morris Pearl to come talk with us. Morris is the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires, their website, patrioticmillionaires.org. Morris, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be on your show.
So I'm sure you saw the ProPublica piece. Are we surprised by anything in there? I mean, it's nothing new, is it?
No. That's the whole point, is that's exactly how it's always been working. You don't pay tax on getting wealthy. You pay tax on this concept called income. Income does not mean stocks going up. Income means getting a paycheck every week with tax fees withheld from it. Or it means selling your stock at a profit. But somebody like Mr. Bezos, he's a billionaire. He doesn't need any income. So of course he has, you know, he owns a huge amount of Amazon. It gets more valuable. He gets richer and richer and richer. And yeah, he doesn't have any income from that. So he doesn't have to pay much taxes. I mean, I don't even see why people are so surprised at that. But I think that's what we have to do, is better publicize how the tax system works and make people understand it, that it's based around people being taxed on their labor, not on their wealth.
And I'm glad you said that, because here's the reality. The right has done a masterful job. And look, I give credit and I'm in awe of how the wealthy in this country and corporations and the right have committed to messaging and to, you know, media, and have invested a lot of time, energy, and money in convincing the working class to, anytime they hear the word taxes, to foam at the mouth like a Pavlovian dog without actually thinking about what you just said. It's them who's paying the taxes, not the guy at the top.
Exactly. I pay myself. I'm not as rich as Mr. Bezos, but I probably pay half the tax rate that the people who work in your office pay, because I get all of my income from long-term capital gains. My tax rates are 0% and 15%.
Now, I just had this conversation the other day with someone who said, well, you're just jealous. You know, these are people who did very well. They worked very hard. We're a country where if you work hard, you get ahead. We don't punish people. So what do you say to the person, Morris, who goes, you know, we don't want to punish people like you. We want everybody to be you.
I don't want to punish anybody. I run a group called the Patriotic Millionaires, for God's sakes. We think everyone should become a millionaire. We just think that those people who are millionaires should pay the same tax rate as those people who work for a living.
So are you in favor of a flat tax then? Is that the idea?
No.
Okay.
We think that people should pay taxes based on how much money they make.
people who make less money should pay lower tax rates than people who make more money, but it should not depend on how you make your money.
Okay.
Whether I make my money selling some stock or whether I make my money working 40 hours a week for 50 weeks a year, you should still pay taxes on the same rules. I don't think it's right that we have one set of rules for people that work for a living and a different set of rules for people who are rich enough they don't have to.
We agree. So, you know, where the thought now is in my mind is the system's working perfect. It's exactly the way it was designed. It's working perfectly. Problem is it's not working for us. How do we go back and then change some of those things? You know, you think back and you go back to the Eisenhower years. It was a much higher top marginal rate. In fact, the tax rates went up every $2,000 from zero to, well, the top rate, which was 92% at the time. Is that the way forward? Do we tax, capital gains at the same rate as income? How do you see us moving forward to make this system a little more, well, where the rich pay a little bit more?
Look, we've made fantastic progress over the past couple of years. We haven't gotten any laws changed. But since the Trump tax cuts for the rich in the end of 2017, people have started to understand this. You know, and people have been reading our book, Tax the Rich. And so people are coming along to our point of view. This was a fringe idea a few years ago. Now the president of the United States is on our side. So I think we are making progress. I think we just have to have the people with us. And we've seen lawmakers working on this. Senator Wyden of Oregon, Ron Wyden, has proposed a bill to tax people on the amount their wealth increases, regardless of whether or not they sell their stock or make machinations or whatnot. If you get richer, you pay taxes on that increase under his proposal. Senator Warren of Massachusetts has proposed that we tax people based on how wealthy they are. And that shouldn't be considered a radical concept. The Commonwealth of Massachusetts was created by people who knew we needed common wealth. And back then they taxed people based on their wealth, it was all land. And they still tax people based on real estate. They still have a real estate tax there and everywhere else. But now most people's wealth is not in their real estate, it's in their stock portfolios and everywhere else. But so middle-class people are still paying a wealth tax because they pay the real estate tax every year. It's only the rich that have gone out of paying a wealth tax. So they think they should return our country to the way it was founded, the wealthy people paying the taxes.
No, and it makes sense, but here we just saw the Gang of 10. 10 Republicans, 10 Democrats who now have, evidently they have a bipartisan agreement on infrastructure, but the one thing that's not in there, how to pay for it by raising the taxes where it needs to be raised.
I don't understand what they're afraid of. All I can think of, Rick, is that they've developed some kind of appeasement policy. Oh, you know, rich people are like our parents. We have to be nice to them and polite and appease them and do whatever they say. It's kind of like their way of thinking of just, you know, we do what our leader tells us to do.
But I go a little simpler. They've taken the pledge. They've sworn a blood oath to Grover Norquist and his group that evidently is more sacred than the oath that they took to defend and uphold the Constitution of the United States. Because, look, you can't get a Republican to say that we're going to raise taxes. I think it's got to be a blood oath. I think they've sworn a secret pact to the devil or something.
Yeah, I mean, I can't explain any better than that. I mean, we need to change the system because we're going to end up with a few rich people and lots of poor people and no middle class. And then it won't be possible to get rich anymore because people get rich by investing in businesses like Amazon, like Netflix, like all the others that depend on people paying their bills every month. People have enough money to do things. If we live in a country filled with poor people, it doesn't work.
No, and that's a problem. I mean, at the end of the day, we've created a system to the winner go the spoils. And now we've almost got the guy who's won the, you know, when I grew up, it was the one who with the most toys at the end wins. We've almost got the guy who's got the most toys. I mean, Jeff Bezos, and now I find out Was it Richard Branson? I think it was his name. They're competing to see which of them can go to space first. I'm going, what? We've got people starving here and you're playing Space Wars.
Well, I have no problem with people going to space. I mean, he can do whatever he wants with his money. I just think that we should change the system. So
right,
that
but here's the thing. $10 billion of that dollars is our money. At the end of the day, we're still paying for their toys. Look, if it was just his money, fine. Go do your thing. But we're still subsidizing them because our tax code is that screwed up.
Well, yes, we are. We are subsidizing people who are not paying their fair share. But still, I have no problem with somebody like Jeff Bezos being very rich. And frankly, the screwed up tax system we have has been around longer than Jeff Bezos has.
Sure.
So it's not like he caused the problem. But I think he's sort of a symbol of how well it works in having the rich get richer and richer and richer and everyone else not.
What do you say to the person, Morris, who goes, no, what we need is we don't need the wealth tax because it's too hard to figure out. We don't need the other thing. We need a consumption tax. I got conservative friends who are all hell-bent on the we need consumption taxes. And I guess, you know, like here what we're doing here in Pennsylvania, don't tax food and clothing. I guess you could make some of those exemptions. Are we a consumption tax guy or thoughts?
But no, I don't think that's a good idea at all. Because if you think about different people, like say you have a guy that makes $80,000 a year driving a truck, he probably spends most of that $80,000 a year. And he would be paying taxes as a certain percentage of his income. Now, say you have the guy who owns the trucking company who makes $8 million a year. He doesn't live 100 times better than the truck driver. He maybe lives 20 times better than the truck driver. So he pays 20 times more taxes, even though he makes 100 times more money. So he has a much lower tax rate on his income than the people that work for him. And that's just not right. The consumption tax essentially taxes working people at a much higher rate than rich people. And I mean, that's why it works well if you're rich, I guess.
Right.
But it's not the right thing to do. That's why I'm so against this idea of increasing the gasoline tax. Because poor people spend a lot more money on gasoline than rich people do. I don't spend anything on gasoline. I don't even have a car. I don't need a car. I live here on Park Avenue. But regular people spend lots of their income on gas money, and increasing their gas bill by even a dollar or two a week, that'll make a big difference to them.
Yeah, no, you're right. And this is where it comes back to the difference in ideologies from the right and the left. I look at Mitt Romney, who was governor of Massachusetts, who while he was running for president said that he didn't raise taxes one time as governor, but he did raise fees on everyone like 500 times. So it's just a different way of getting money out of poor and working class folks and allowing people like himself to get away. And this is why I find it interesting. We've got millionaires in the Senate who are A-okay with taxing me and other working stiffs, but you know, their peers, not so much.
Yeah, the average American, averaging across the entire country, pays on average more than $100 a year in gasoline tax now.
So what happens when they go to a mileage tax, which is what some are trying to push out there, because as we're going to go to electric vehicles, got to pay for those roads somehow. How do you see that shifting then?
I would prefer a system where people pay taxes based on how rich they are, with rich people having higher tax rates than people that work for a living. I don't think it's good to have a system where everyone pays taxes the same amount. Essentially, if like everyone who drives paying the same amount, well, that sounds fair, but it means that poor people are spending a much higher percentage of their income on this tax than rich people are. So that's why it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with you on that. So for me, it comes back to the nuts and bolts. And are we moving in that direction? Do you see the policies? I know you said Wyden's come out with a bill. Is that Elizabeth Warren's got her wealth tax? Do you see that actually passing? I mean, we're in a moment where there's going to be not a Republican that's going to come along. So do you get Manchin, Sinema? Do you get the conservative Democrats to come along?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not the guy who got 75 million votes. So I'm not a political prognosticator. But I think that we're in the moment, and it could be now or never, you know? And it's going to come down to Kamala Harris walking into the room and picking up the gavel and banging the gavel and say the clerk will call the roll, and, you know, ignoring the people yelling about filibustering and whatnot.
So what's the suggestion for just our listeners? I mean, at the end of the day, one of the reasons I like having you come on is because every time you come on, people are going, I can't believe a rich guy is saying raise my taxes. And I always write back. He's not saying raise my taxes and squander my money. He's saying raise the taxes because we know we need stuff. But, you know, what's the marching order out of this?
Well, get your congresspeople, your senators, and your president to keep remembering that you are behind this effort. You know, tell the White House that you're still supporting the president's efforts. If you have one of those Democratic senators, remind them that you're still on the case. You know, the ones from New Hampshire, the ones from Delaware, they need to be convinced too. And we need to make sure they're on the case. I mean, that's all I can say is we live in a democracy. Our representatives should eventually answer to the people. And if you're one of the people that they answer to, well, make sure they know what your answer is.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, you know, when you talk about these tax proposals, they're overwhelmingly popular. I mean, when you lay it out as you have, and I've had very few people push back and defend, you know, the Jeff Bezoses of the world. They're very popular, but still they're not getting through. Doesn't it ultimately come back to us, the voters, we, the voters, for continually putting people in who aren't doing what we want them to do?
Well, I hope you're right, because that means the voters can do better. I mean, there's a lot of challenges, even in your state of Pennsylvania, there's challenges because of the way the lines are drawn. And, you know, the voters in the middle of the state having more power than the voters in the edges of the state. But those are things that can be overcome. We don't really have different interests based on where we live. You know, people who live in the middle of the state actually have more of an interest in not paying gas tax than people who live downtown. I think we have to understand that our interests are really together, and that our principles and our financial interests are really the same thing. It's not valid to say that, oh, on principle, we don't want rich people to pay more taxes. Well, that's not a good principle. It's just not a good idea. It's not that you're putting some valid principle above your own economic interests. So you're putting some stupid idea from greedy rich people ahead of your own economic interests.
I like how you put that. So how do we get the book, Tax the Rich, How Loopholes and Lobbyists Make the Rich Even Richer? How do we get a copy of that?
Sure, it's in bookstores everywhere. Whatever your favorite bookstore, you can get a copy. Or in fact, if you want, I will send you a copy.
And how do we get that?
So look at taxtherich.com, look at patrioticmillionaires.org, and send us a message on our patrioticmillionaires.org website.
Good stuff.
And we will get copies.
And we'll make sure we get links out on social media. Morris, always great talk with you. Thanks so much for taking time for us.
Anytime, Rick. Have a good night, sir.
You as well. Our good friend Morris Pearl. Make sure you check out their website. Patrioticmillionaires.org is the website. We'll get the links out on how you can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1969. That was the day that labor leader John L. Lewis died. Born to a Welsh-American coal mining family in Iowa, Lewis became the leading champion of industrial unionism in the 1930s. He served as president of the United Mine Workers of America from 1920 until 1960. He was the founder of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. The CIO split off from the American Federation of Labor with the aim of organizing the thousands of workers who powered the U.S. industrial machine. Some public officials and the media accused the CIO of being infiltrated with communism. In 1937, Lewis delivered a speech in Washington, D.C. to deny these claims. The speech captured Lewis's commitment and passion for industrial labor organizing. He declared, quote, "The workers of the nation were tired of waiting for corporate industry to right their economic wrongs, to alleviate their social agony, and to grant them their political rights. Despairing of fair treatment, they resolved to do something for themselves. They therefore have organized a new labor movement conceived within the principles of the National Bill of Rights and committed to the proposition that the workers are free to assemble in their own forms, voice their own grievances, declare their own hopes, and contract on even terms with modern industry for the sale of their only material possession, their labor." He went on to say, quote, "Under the banner of the Committee of Industrial Organization, American labor is on the march. Its objectives today are those it had in the beginning, to strive for the unionization of our unorganized millions of workers and for the acceptance of collective bargaining as a recognized American institution."
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So since we've been booted off of YouTube, I can talk about the crazy woman from Ohio with the vaccine and the 5G, thinking that everyone's going to be magnetic. And I, you know, there's, to be honest, if she's right, I can see a use for that. I'd never lose my keys. You know, I could probably see a use for that. But it's not accurate. It's not true. And she tried and it failed. And it, you know, it's sad. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, is it true? Can we all be Magno Man? That's why I've asked our good friend Dr. Keith Pocheck to come share some thoughts. Keith, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So no spoons on your forehead, no knives, no forks stuck to you, nothing.
No,
none
of that, right? I've kept all the metal out of the room just to make sure that I'm safe.
Yeah. I wanted to figure out how I could get, like, you know, things flying across to, you know, kind of make like a, you know, an image, but I didn't really want to have knives flying across me during the show.
Yeah, and so I mean, if that's accurate, and we know that it's like not even close, then no one who has been vaccinated could get an MRI, thanks to the ridiculous magnetic power in an MRI. So, and I'm sure that there are thousands and thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands of people who have gotten an MRI after getting the vaccine administered, and you know, they all survived.
Yeah, this is one of those moments, though, Keith, where I go, you know, I have such respect for doctors and people who have gone through the years of schooling and the grueling process of becoming a doctor. And I got to be honest, my faith and my reverence, you know, kind of stepping down a bit, because you're seeing some of these quackpots coming out and coming up with some pretty fanciful ideas. And I think it's all about making money, but that's just me. Should my faith be shaken in our medical profession?
No, I mean, I think that what we've got to understand is that there are careerists and grifters everywhere in every field, in every industry in the world, not just in America. And so, there are physicians out there who will say anything to be able to, in the hopes that it will make them, it'll be their meal ticket, or they'll be able to get a check out of it. So, that holds true for every industry, including medicine.
Yeah. I mean, I still have people sending me hydroxychloroquine, and I still have people sending me this other one that begins with an I. I don't remember it off the top of my head.
Oh, ivermectin? Ivermectin?
That's it. That's the miracle cure, and how, you know, I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, but I do listen to people who I think are, and those don't seem to be what the claims are claiming that I see on YouTube, which I believe very little, if anything, I see on YouTube, to be honest.
It is. And I mean, and so we're just awash in misinformation. And I think that, you know, when you have a pathogen like COVID, I mean, it's the one of the sneakiest, like probably most diabolical infections, if you look at it in certain ways, just because, you know, the vast majority of people are going to recover regardless of what you do. And so as long as you don't kill someone, you could give them virtually anything and they would be singing its praises when they got better. And then, you know, you have these folks who inexplicably, you know, I mean, we've obviously identified some risk factors for people who are going to do poorly, but you also have these folks who just like lose the lottery. You know, they're young, they're healthy. They otherwise don't have any major health problems, and they get uber sick and they need to be admitted to the ICU and they need to be put on a ventilator or they wind up having major morbidity or they die.
Right.
And that's, you know, when you take a virus that's so easily transmissible, even if you have a very low mortality rate, if it's easily transmissible and a lot of the population is going to get it, that's going to be far deadlier than, and we've seen this right now, it's going to be far deadlier than something like Ebola, that has a super high mortality rate, but it kills people so quickly that they can't spread it.
Right. So here's where my problem is. There are so many grifters out there. There are so many 10 pennies and the rest of them that the real concerns just kind of get, you know, lost. And there are some real concerns about, you know, some people getting the vaccine. And there are some real things out there. But their numbers are fairly minuscule, as I understand.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we've obviously gone through the J&J Janssen vaccine kind of dance here in the U.S. and it's kind of fallen out of favor here in the U.S. but it's being administered worldwide just because the risk of having a major problem is so infinitesimally low. But here in the U.S., you know, we have a tough time understanding how unbelievably fortunate we are that we can go and get a series of these mRNA vaccines that are, honestly, when we look back on this in 50 years and after both of us are dead, the history books are going to say that the development and the mass production and distribution of the mRNA vaccine will be the towering human achievement of this entire pandemic. And Americans can go and get this vaccine for free. And it's unbelievably safe and it's unbelievably effective, like as far as vaccines go. And it's proven. And now, you know, we're coming up on 2 billion doses of these mRNA vaccines being administered around the world. And there are no serious long-term ill effects. And we still can't overcome, I guess, the disinformation from the other side, who has, you know, probably 30 to 40% of the population in America convinced that this is something that's worse than COVID itself.
No, and that's the scary part. You know, what's interesting to me, though, is, you know, their hero, their dear leader, is someone who wants to be known as the godfather of the vaccine, and yet they won't take it, even if he is the godfather, which is kind of weird, I think.
No, it's true, and I think that, he could have done, I mean, obviously, that we could point to 1,000 things that he could have done better as far as looking out for the American people, but you know, for him to, if he had come out and publicly admitted that post COVID, he went and got vaccinated, just what that would have done, I think, in the Republican population, you know, we would maybe, instead of seeing just over half of our population vaccinated with one dose, we would probably be seeing 70% plus, like be approaching true herd immunity. Just from that fact, just because, you know, he, you know, like him or not, he's got that degree of sway among that percentage of our population.
Right. No, and we'll see. We'll see how this plays out, because I know a bunch of people who come hell or high water. There's no way they're going to do it. And so the question becomes, if they don't, what's the risk to the rest of us?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the best answer a lot of times is I don't know, and I don't know. So that's where we are. I mean, I think that we're not really sure what's going to happen with the variants. Are we going to deal with variants that evade the vaccine or not? Are we going to, you know, any time that there's particularly an RNA virus that's out there in significant numbers, it's going to mutate just so rapidly that, you know, you can't really guess, you know, what's going to happen in the next, you know, in the coming weeks to months. So, you know, we've kind of been in this race against time, and I feel like we've almost hit a wall in the U.S. on how many folks we're going to get vaccinated. I mean, I think we can still send out the messaging, and I think that right now at this point, it's person to person, word of mouth. I know someone who got it and they did fine. I mean, I think those are the contacts right now at this phase of it that are going to mean the most as far as getting more people vaccinated.
Yeah. Let me ask you the other side of this. What if you had it? You know, I originally had saw that, you know, some people were saying, well, even if you had it, you got to go get the vaccine. Now I'm seeing some stuff coming out of Cleveland Clinic saying maybe you don't have to get it. Is there any advice on you know, let's say you had it and you got through it, especially if you're talking about young kids, you know.
I did see one, what seemed to be, and I need to find the study for you. Maybe I can share it, you know, on your page, that made a pretty strong argument that, if you had COVID and you got a single dose of mRNA vaccine following that, that it was that was basically as effective as getting the two dose regimen. Now that has not, I haven't seen multiple studies saying the same thing.
Right.
And knowing how safe and widely available the vaccine is in the US, I mean, I would say you stick to the regimen that the CDC and the drug makers have suggested.
Because one of the things that, you know, that some of the right wing folks who have made arguments, you know, some of the things that make sense a little bit, the kernel of truth in a lot of these conspiracy is that, you know, when I was a kid, I got mumps, I got chicken pox, I got measles, I got all those things. I didn't have a vaccine for those. And, you know, I got through them as were, you know, people 10 years younger than me didn't get any of those things because they all had vaccines. Yet I haven't had any adverse effects, you know, all these years later. And I've been around people who've had it. So the theory, you know, and again, this is part of what was going on during the Trump years, is that if you had it, yeah, you've built up an immunity as you would have been vaccinated. Is that accurate or is that too simplistic?
I mean, I think that that's a little bit of a stretch. From what I understand, the immunity from infection itself versus having a full vaccine series is not in the same ballpark. So that's why it's recommended, I think, for folks who have even had COVID to go ahead and get a full vaccine series. And the other thing too is that you know, people died of measles. People had horrible complications of polio, and you know, and then we had a vaccine that could reliably prevent it, and it wasn't politicized. To go get the polio vaccine. It was like, of course I'm going to go get my kid vaccinated against polio. I mean, it was just uniformly accepted, I think, across all of America, that science had given us this, you know, incredible weapon to fight this what was then new, a virus that was causing limb paralysis and, you know, long-term neurologic complications in kids that were going to last forever. And it wasn't politicized. And so that's I think that's one of the big differences between now and then, is that everything at this point, even surrounding science itself, is politicized. And science is not a political, field at all. But you know, we have talking heads, and we have media, and we have, you know, other sources, and we have foreign influencers who make science itself a political football. And, yeah. And you know, and that's the you know, that's the sad state of America. And I don't, you know, we're not going to overcome that anytime soon.
Yeah, but they also, back during the era of polio, they didn't have social media. You know,
true. Yes, that's exactly right.
You didn't have Dr. Tenpenny in Cleveland doing 10,000 hours of research from the beginning of the virus until now, which if you do the math is like 20 hours a day of research. And you go, I don't know how you did that, but, you know, good luck, I guess. Is there 10,000 hours of research to be had? I don't know. So let's talk about the good stuff. Are we getting through some of this? Is life getting back to normal? I know I see, you know, people going to sporting events, people, you know, nobody's wearing a mask that I see. And when you go out and about, are we getting to the other side of this, do you think?
I think in the U.S., for now, we are in a honeymoon phase. I hope that it's not just a honeymoon phase, but I also think that, you know, a lot of what's going on in the rest of the world that's lagging so far behind us is going to affect what happens to us here over the next 6 months to 2 years, to 5 years, to 10 years. And that's why I'm so heartened to see that, you know, that as our demand for vaccine has fallen in the U.S., we're starting to share it more widely with the rest of the world. I mean, this a public health crisis like this was something that's this transmissible, with travel being as easy as it is across the globe. You know, that's the only responsible thing to do.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you the side of this, because, you know, I was just reading a story today about a cruise line that did a cruise down like the St. Martin's in that area. And they tested everyone. They made sure everyone had the vaccine before they got on the cruise. And yet they came across a couple people who then tested positive. Is it possible to get the virus after you've been vaccinated?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you look at the vaccine efficacy rate, and we're seeing numbers between 90 and 95% or so. And that means 1 out of 10 to 1 out of 20 people who have an exposure, who have been vaccinated, are still going to, you know, go ahead and contract the disease. Now, there's science there to back up the assertion that if you've been vaccinated, it certainly seems like you're going to have a less severe case if you do wind up coming down with COVID. But for sure, yeah. I mean, you know, even though the vaccine is one of the most amazingly effective vaccines that's ever been invented, when you look at the mRNA vaccines, it's not perfect. So, you know, 1 out of 10, 1 out of 20 people, when they have an exposure, yes, you know, they're going to wind up contracting COVID.
So, last question I got for you, because my kids want to know. We've got Green Day tickets in August. We got, in fact, two sets of them, one in Hershey, one in Philadelphia. Do the kids get to go to Green Day?
Is it indoor or outdoor?
They're both outdoor.
They're both outdoor. And how old are the kids?
12 and 15.
So are they going to be vaccinated?
Yes.
Right on, baby. Let's do it.
Okay. Have fun. They're going to be very happy with you.
Yeah.
Because we missed them last year. They're hell-bent on going this year.
Basket Case is one of the best songs, I think, that you know, from my high school days ever made. Yeah. Amazing. I love their drum.
Gonna be a great concert. But Keith, I appreciate the time and your insight. I'm sure this wouldn't have gotten us banned on YouTube, but I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks Rick. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff, as always. Our good friend Dr. Keith Pocheck. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. Police in New Orleans shot at maritime workers striking against the United Fruit Company. Two workers were wounded. A third lay dead in the street. At the time of the strike, the port of New Orleans was one of the busiest U.S. ports for importing bananas. 20-25% of banana imports came through the Crescent City. Tourists to New Orleans would even stop at the docks and watch the unloading of bananas. The United Fruit Company, along with its competitor Standard Fruit, both had headquarters in the land of the Big Easy. United Fruit Company would go on to become one of the most notorious United States companies to operate overseas. The banana giants forged massive plantations in Central American countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and Colombia. They controlled an enormous amount of land and evaded paying taxes. The company meddled in foreign governments and built relationships with ruthless dictators to ensure operation of its plantations. In 1928, the Colombian army brutally crushed a strike of United Fruit workers. In what came to be known as the Banana Massacre, estimates of workers killed reached into the hundreds. The company even went so far as to help initiate a U.S.-backed coup in Guatemala in 1954. The business practices of the United Fruit Company brought them many critics in the United States. One of those critics was Little Steven, best known for his role in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band. He released this song, Bitter Fruit, about the company. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.